Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Coming up, we have another installment in our series of unexpected pop moments called That Was a Hit. Only this time, we'll be looking at a hugely successful song that was actually never a hit. And I can almost guarantee you, you will be surprised when you hear it. Speaking of the unexpected, if you looked at the top 10 selling albums last week, you'd see the usual suspects, your Justin Timberlake, your Daft Punk, the new Superman soundtrack, the reformed Black Sabbath, but you'd also find this little surprise package.
You only live once, that's the motto, so take a chill pill, ease off the throttle.
Yeah. Never go to loud clubs, cause it's bad for your ears. Your friends will all be sorry when they can't hear.
And stay the hell away from drugs, cause they're not legal. Then bury all your money in the backyard like a beagle.
Yes, the Lonely Island, the hip-hop parody band that rose to fame on Saturday Night Live, has a top 10 album. Clearly, times are good for musical parodists, which these days seems to mean anyone who knows how to get onto YouTube. So we'll take a look at the state of the art of poking fun at pop. But first, we meet a global pop star, and she ain't fooling around. Kylie Minogue's song, Can't Get You Out of My Head, wasn't just a hit. It was the number one song in more than 40 countries in 2001. The Australian-born singer, actor, and fashion designer has a new single and a new book and joins us here today. Kylie Minogue, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you so much.
So, in a career full of milestones, I mean, it seems like a lot of things are coming together now. 25 years in music,
yep.
45th birthday, and now making your first album with Jay-Z's Roc Nation, mm-hmm. working with The Dream, the producer, songwriter.
Yes.
And already there's, you know, there's talk of this new record being somehow different. For you, how?
Well, I hope it's going to be a bit different. Otherwise, I've wasted my time coming over here. I believe everyone's aware that my DNA that's in my music that fans want and they love is that will be there no matter what situation you put me in because that's who I am and what I do. But I absolutely thrive and love being in new situations with being, you know, having new stimulus around and different ideas. And and I think that a lot of the producers I've worked with through Roc Nation on this album are people that, actually, there's some that are dreams come true. I don't know if I can mention the names yet because the album's not done, but definitely I found myself in the studio with a couple of producers going, this was on my wish list, and here I am. So it's really cool.
That's, you know, it's kind of funny to think 25 years in the business and huge success around the globe that there are still things you'd always wanted to do that you never had a chance to do.
Always. The list of what I haven't done is endless. You know, there's always... I'm too curious, actually. Sometimes I'm too curious for my own good, but I just... New experiences are just such wonderful... opportunities, and I feel so thankful to have those opportunities.
Well, now, as you say, the album's not done. It's still in process, but we have this this single called Skirt.
Yeah, we dropped a buzz track for the fans on my birthday, which was a surprise for them, and it's going really well. I'm super pleased.
This is my guest, Kylie Minogue, with a song called Skirt.
Skirt.
Just a little bit of Kylie Minogue's new single, Skirt, written with The Dream.
Correct.
Interesting kind of rhythm track there.
Yeah, well, the track, we heard the track, all of us fell in love with it, and basically Roc Nation said there's only one guy who can write on this, and that's The Dream. So I got to work with him for a few days, and he was amazing to... Well, it was amazing to watch him work, the way he just has this stream of consciousness and lyrics, melody just comes out. He's got an incredible engineer who's like the other half of his brain who just manages to capture this this wave of information that comes from him.
And the guy has a string of global hits to his credit,
yeah.
You know, having written Single Ladies for Beyonce and Umbrella for Rihanna. Now, the title Skirt sort of leads us to your other big recent project.
That's a nice segue. It does. Yeah.
Kylie Fashion. Uh-huh. This enormous, handsome, very, you know, lavishly, obviously illustrated hardcover book about your long career in music and in fashion.
Yes.
Was that an early kind of love of yours as a kid growing up?
Probably around 14 is when I really, you know, hormones kicked in, teenage. I became obsessed with music. It was the early 80s. So I was really into new romantic music, a lot of the London scene and all of that. But anyway, hand in hand with that, my obsession with fashion was cemented. I used to go to the market. I would drool over, you know, anything. You just... To go and buy one thing at the store, I would put it on lay-by. So you had to put down $5, go back the next week, put another $5, which seems so crazy now where you want something, you press a button and you get it.
Right.
But throughout my career in music, fashion's played such a big part and that got more and more so as the further I got into my career and the more I got to know about myself and my sense of style and how... best to use that to express myself.
Now, you know, musical styles come and go, and, you know, over the course of a 25-year career, you might look at certain musical moments and think, all right, well, it was of its time.
Yeah, it's not all fun and games looking back at a 25-year career, that's for sure.
Well, 25 years of fashion, I mean, are there things now
Let's
you
say
look-
there are a few sartorial mishaps, yes. I definitely things I would... be more than happy to just dispose of, sweep under the rug, pretend, you know, I've hit a race in the memory. Yeah, didn't happen. But I first became well known in the late 80s, so already that's
a
know,
very different
big
look,
hair
isn't it?
And big earrings and big all sorts. And then going through a kind of more experimental phase, you know, that kind of grunge period in the 90s and 2000, I kind of got my sparkle back on, and it's kind of moving for me to have a look through that book and see there's through fashion there's so much of my life in that book, and of course I have stories for every page of what happened beforehand, what happened afterwards, what the situation was. Fashion's played such a big part in my life.
I mean, early on, your debut kind of unexpected out of left field hit, your cover of The Locomotion back in the late 80s.
Yeah.
The video for that is, you know, it's very 80s.
It's very, I think I've got Lycra on. I think there's a bit of, I don't know if there was Lycra in it, but there's a workout. Outfit.
Yeah, there's the kind of the workout outfit, the puffy dress.
Yes, the rah-rah skirt, the little bow in the hair. What else is there? Oh God, there's a shot in that video that's just
the baggy denim.
Honestly, the hair. Yeah. I must add so much mousse and the scrunch dry, and really, it's quite amazing. I've lived to tell the tale. I got through that.
And in fact, there was a song attached. This song from Kylie Minogue.
You do.
Locomotion, debut worldwide hit for my guest Kylie Minogue. And
what a blast from the past.
Yeah. You can't keep a good song down, you know, Carole King, Jerry Geffen.
You like that. Absolutely cannot, and that's why I loved it, which is what it was my suggestion to record it as a demo, and I had no idea that I would end up even in the music business. But yeah, I'm very thankful for that song, and it's an amazing track.
Kylie Minogue's with us on Soundcheck, the chart-topping singer, songwriter, actor, fashion icon. Her new book is called Kylie Fashion. The new single is called Skirt. The 12th album is in progress on Jay-Z's Roc Nation label. And, I mean, fashion, you know, people talk about how scents, smells can, like, bring back all kinds of memories and stuff. What about, like, seeing, going through some of these old pictures of the clothing? Does that...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, every page, 1,000 memories. We actually did an exhibition in my hometown, Melbourne, at the Performing Arts Museum there. I've donated all of my stage costumes to them, so they're preserved. You cannot even look at them without white gloves. It was also exhibited at the V&A Museum in London. So they have some gravitas that, you know, they're not just clothes. These are costumes. They mark a point in time. They mark a kind of... pop culture,
right.
I guess. But what was interesting when I went to look at the first exhibition, and for other people handling the clothes, they're kind of these items. But for me, it was quite strange to look at them as inanimate objects, because I have, you know, say, for example, a touring costume. I've done 100 shows in that costume. Blood, sweat, tears, you know, joy, thrills, etc. The memories are all held in those clothes.
What about those gold hot pants in
what
the
video? What about those gold hot pants
spinning around in 2000? I mean, there's all kinds of tales about where they came from. Were they?
Would you like me to clarify?
Would you?
A very good girlfriend of mine bought them for 50 pence, 50p in London. She's a photographer and artist, and has a kind of natural styling ability. And so she gave them to me. They lived in my cupboard. I wore them once to a fancy dress party, Nerds, Tarts, and Tourists. I'll let you guess which one I went as. And they kind of just hung around in my wardrobe until I was with my stylist at the time, and we were thinking what to do for the video for Spitting Around. And I think he kind of managed to extricate, pull out these tiny little things. So what about these? Yeah, okay. I tried them on for the director, and she just about had a heart attack. She said, yep, yes, those, yes. And I remember being pretty self-conscious on the day of the video. I kept, you know, between takes, I'm covering myself up, and I was just...
Because the hot pants were simply not doing the job.
They were not covering me up. But as usual on a video, you forget the real world exists, and by the end of the day, well, that was it. I was sliding up and down that bar and, you know, forgot about being self-conscious at all. So I like that from very humble beginnings. I think they're from the 70s. They're actually vintage already. So I've kind of double vintaged them.
So they're genuine hot pants from the six-month period where hot pants were actually a fashion statement.
Yes.
Kylie Minogue is my guest on Soundcheck. You should still check out the video for this song, but listen to it for the moment, Spinning Around from 2000. Kylie Minogue's hit Spinning Around from 2000. She's my guest on Soundcheck. Back in 2009, Nick Cave wrote a novel called The Death of Bunny Munro.
Mm-hmm.
And while he was here in our studio, I
you had the divine presence of Nick Cave in here. I'm
Nick's
so
been
thrilled.
Here a couple of times over the years.
I adore him.
Yeah.
Oh.
Well, you know, I said to him, you know, I read your book, and there's this scene of, you know, Bunny Munro, he's thinking about Kylie Minogue and the hot pants and the song, and it's really graphic and sexual.
It's slightly awkward.
Slightly awkward, and I asked him about it. How does she feel about all of this?
I don't know. She hasn't gotten back to me yet. I mean, look, I know Kylie, and at least I hope she'll take this with a certain sense of humor. And I mean, she knows how much I admire her, and for years I've been a kind of one man promotional machine for Kylie Minogue. So I'm just taking a little bit back.
Oh, that's
taking
brilliant.
A little back.
Yeah, well, he's taken it. He's transformed it, Nick Cave style.
Yeah.
Now he sent me a copy of the book with some kind of apology in the front. Look, Nick Cave, as far as I'm concerned, can do whatever he likes because I love him so much.
Well, the two of you got together last year for the Abbey Road sessions.
Yes.
Now that, I mean, talk about, you know, you were talking before about 25 years in the business, having a moment to reflect. This album felt like someone who had a moment to reflect on her career.
Yeah, we re-recorded a bunch of hits at Abbey Road Studios, which was already a thrill to be recording there. And it was such... It was on my wish list to do orchestral or acoustic versions of songs, because I kind of touch upon doing... I touch upon those in on tour.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we'll kind of break it down and do a different version of a song. So all of that was fantastic. And then Nick Cave agreed to come and re-record Where the Wild Roses Grow. And when we recorded it, it was great because we were just sat next to each other.
And do you do that with the orchestra?
We did it
there?
With the band. Well, that one wasn't orchestrated because it was orchestrated in the original version, so it seemed more interesting to just do that with the band. But at one point we looked at each other and went, did we? When's the last time we did? We both needed the lyrics.
Mm.
How does it go again? And it was interesting to see how we would deliver it however many years afterwards it was. I can't even think how many years before we'd recorded it, but you know, a number of years had passed and we'd both been through a lot of things, and there we were. I was thrilled that he was happy to be part of that album.
Kylie Minogue with Nick Cave and the Abbey Road Sessions recording of 2012. The song's called Where the Wild Roses Grow.
They call me the wild rose, but my name was Eliza Day. Why they call me that, I do not know. For my name was Eliza Day.
From the first day I saw her, I knew she was the one. She stared in my eyes and smiled, for her lips were the color of the roses that grew down the river, all bloody and wild.
When he knocked on my door and entered the room, my trembling subsided in his sure embrace. He would be my first man, and with a careful hand, he wiped out the tears that ran down my face. They call me the wild rose.
That is Kylie Minogue with Nick Cave, Where the Wild Roses Grow, the 2012 version at the Abbey Road Studios. Kylie and I just doing a little quick math here in the studio. So the Murder Ballads record that you guys did, that was 96.
I believe it was 96, yeah.
So that's a 16, it was 16 years. Is the reason you both needed the lyric sheet for that?
Stop. Amazing.
The book is called Kylie Fashion, and it charts 25 years of what Kylie was wearing while she was singing and dancing her way through the charts in some 40 countries around the world. Kylie Minogue with us on Soundcheck today. So Skirt is out. The new record will be your 12th. Any kind of vague release date?
I'm hoping before the end of the year, but I couldn't promise that.
All right. Among the other things that you've been dealing with, a diagnosis of cancer in 2005, which you've recently begun to talk about. Mm-hmm. How hard is it to talk about
well,
that?
Well, it's really hard, A, because you don't really want to go back there. But what I find more difficult is if you're going to talk about it, you could talk. There's so much to say about your experience, about you know, how hopefully you could help others. But I find this, it's hard to condense the story. And I always say, cancer is not a soundbite. I can't just throw in a few comments about it because it's involved and it's emotional. But whatever, I do. It's a important part of my life. I certainly didn't see that coming. And the love and support that I felt at that time, I just want to be able to give that back to everyone and you know, help spread my message of courage, of strength, of positivity. And I mean, here we are talking about my career and all of the things that I hope are in front of me, and that's what I want patients to know is, just stay strong and get through the other side.
And there is something to look ahead to. I mean, you were recently honored with this year's Courage Award by the EIF Women's Cancer Fund. I know
I was
very
touched by that.
Yeah.
I actually didn't know if I could accept that because, firstly, I thought I'm going to burst into tears on stage. I thought, okay, I have to take a big breath here. And
nobody would have blamed you.
Well, I managed to hold it together, and I did say yes, because obviously it's a great honor to receive that. But I had to think long and hard about how do I talk about courage, because sure, you have it, but you don't. It's not something that I had every day. There's definitely times where you're just absolutely terrified, and you don't feel like you are particularly courageous when there's so many more courageous people in the world. But in the end, it was a really beautiful night, an event that I hope to support again in the future.
The 2013 Courage Award from the Entertainment Industry Foundation's Women's Cancer Fund going to Kylie Minogue, my guest on Soundcheck today. Another thread running through your career. You started as a TV actor as a kid, and
yeah,
you've been getting more into that again lately.
Yeah, I started acting when I was 11, crazily, and when I acted throughout some of my years at school. I finished school, managed to get a job when I finished school acting, and so music kind of came after that, and seem to take over recently.
So when I said before about Locomotion that it was an out of left field hit for us, was it out of left field for you too?
It was, although when I was 17, I made a demo tape. I was
so you were,
into music.
Okay.
I really wanted to do music. But at that stage, because I was acting, I kind of thought this demo tape is more for if you go being going for a casting and they want to know
if you can sing
you go, here's my cassette. I don't know where said cassette is these days. It's somewhere. I did three songs. New Attitude by Patti LaBelle, Dim All the Lights by Donna Summer, and Just Once by Quincy Jones.
Wow.
That was my demo tape. Anyway, so Locomotion, I performed with some of the cast of the TV show that I was in. So it did kind of come from left field.
All right.
But I got back into acting 2 years ago. I had a part in a French film called Holy Motors, which was just, it was so thrilling. I was just so happy to be back on set. It's so different to music. I love them equally, but because I haven't done much acting in recent years, it just felt really refreshing and, you know, that kind of feeling terrified, can I do this, is just exhilarating. So I had a ball.
All right. So more of that in the future?
I hope so, yeah.
But in the more immediate future, the single Skirt has been released. New
right
record.
Now, Rock Nation
is waiting for that 12th record to be finished. The book is out. It's called Kylie Fashion, 25 years of what Kylie Minogue has been, or who Kylie Minogue has been wearing, I guess I should say. Mm. Kylie, it's been great fun having you with us in the studio today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kylie Minogue's latest album isn't out yet, but the new album from the comedy team known as The Lonely Island is, and it cracked the top 10 on Billboard's albums chart. Music critic Jody Rosen joins us to talk about the state of pop parody. Plus, an excerpt from a recent performance in the Green Space by Robert Randolph and the Family Band. This is Soundcheck.
YOLO, you only live once. The battle cry of a generation. This life is a precious gift, so don't get too crazy. It's not worth the risk.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The hip-hop parody trio known as The Lonely Island recently released their third studio album. It's called The Whack Album, and it actually debuted in the top 10 of the Billboard charts, giving you some idea as to what big business pop parody has become. Jody Rosen of New York Magazine is their pop music critic and joins us here in the Soundcheck studio to talk about it. Jody, welcome back.
Thank you, John. Hello.
The Whack Album, Andy Samberg, Yorma Taconi, and Akiva Schaffer. I mean, this is big business now. They debuted at number 10 with this record.
Yeah, no, I mean, they're a big deal. I mean, let's forgetting about their, you know, record sales figures, because after all, those don't really matter these days. look at their viral video success. You know, their collectively, their songs have been viewed, forget about listened to, millions of times.
And as you write in your article about them for New York Magazine, their cast of guest characters on this record is worthy of a Jay-Z record.
Yeah. I'm. You know, who's on here? We've got Adam Levine of Maroon 5, T-Pain, Justin Timberlake, of course, their frequent collaborator.
Lady Gaga.
Lady Gaga is on here. You know, a lot of these songs began as digital shorts on Saturday Night Live, where all three of Lonely Island's members were writers. Andy Samberg was a cast member, mm-hmm. of course. But yeah, they command a lot of respect, and they draw a star-studded cast. And I think the secret to their success is both the fact that they're good comedians and fine musicians. They make good records. So these songs work as comedy and as music. They're smart about music. They're kind of, I suppose you could call them music critics in their way. They understand hip hop very well, and they're adept at sending up its tropes.
As they do in this song called Semicolon. This is The Lonely Island from the new record called The Whack Album.
It's right under your nose, semicolon, mouth, opposite and north, semicolon, south, right over your home, semicolon, attic, hooked on semicolons, semicolon, attic.
We got the game on lock, toy chest, you're too big for your clothes, boys fast. You know we out of control. No breaks. Your birthday party sucks. No game. When it comes to punctuation, you know we're number one. Into the people of every nation. Feel the power of the
semicolons. We rest our case.
No, actually, those are examples of colons. You all get Fs.
Wait, what?
The Lonely Island, featuring Solange, Beyoncé's younger sister.
Right.
Semicolon is the name of that?
Semicolon's the name of that. What they're sending up there is hashtag rap, which is this you know, rap style, lyrical style, where you will say a phrase and then a single word or hashtag that somehow is a gloss or explicates the phrase, whatever. It sounds similar to, for instance, a 2 Chainz song. Actually, that lyric that we heard where they rhymed attic and addict, I actually heard on a a Two Chainz song. So I don't know if that's deliberate or they just those, you know, great minds think alike.
Yeah.
But in any case, it sound, you know, the music, I think that's part of the thing. The music, you know, it's actually that's a catchy song.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I like the song as a song, and it's just it's hilarious.
It occurred to me as we were listening to that, if I weren't actually understanding the words, I would totally buy that as a song.
Right.
You know, that it would convince me that was just another pop song.
Which is really their secret weapon, I think. I mean, in the piece I wrote for New York Magazine, I talked a lot about Weird Al Yankovic, who's kind course, the granddaddy of the current wave of pop parodists. But I think, crucially, Lonely Island, they really sound like the stuff that you hear on the radio, whereas Weird Al, okay, he played this, the music sounded somewhat similar, but he was always, you know, singing in that dorky kind of nerd voice, which set it off a bit. Lonely Island, I think their strength really is that they could pass, as you say.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, speaking of Weird Al, I mean, you also have written about the time back in 1985, I guess it was, when Madonna basically called Weird Al out for not parodying one of her songs.
Right. Yeah, no, this was, I think this is another example of Madonna's incredible savvy because, you know, this was when she was, it was at the time of the Like a Virgin album. She was becoming Madonna in mm-hmm. capital letters, huge. And she was sort of like, you know, where's my Weird Al parody? You know, he's done Michael Jackson. When's it going to be my turn? And sure enough, you know, he came up with Like a Surgeon. But what I think Madonna understood is that when your song is burlesqued, when it's sent up, made fun of, it means it's a major song. It's kind of a, you know, Weird Al in his way is a canonizer, a guy who affirms that this song is a big deal.
A part of our pop culture.
Right.
And in the case of Like a Virgin, it became Weird Al's Like a Surgeon.
I finally made it through med school. Somehow I made
Yankovic, Like a Surgeon, and who can forget the video of him with the chainsaw?
The chainsaw and, you know, guys in scrubs washing their hands and someone else doing
washing the dishes. Now, that, you know, that sort of gets to another point of a lot of this pop parody stuff. Very often there's a visual element. I mean, you know, Weird Al was making a name for himself just on the radio, but video really catapulted him and his parodies to the next level. And that seems to be part and parcel of what, you know, the Lonely Island and the current crop are doing.
Yeah, that's what made Lonely Island. And that's actually, I mean, the interesting thing about musical parody today is it's become, you know, via the internet, has become kind of democratized. So everybody and their uncle is doing a musical parody. If there's a song which is a big hit, you know, you get together with your friends in the garage or whatever, turn on the laptop camera, and you can come up with your own Weird Al type parody song. And it's very interesting. I think that this has become a kind of lingua franca of popular culture, of pop music culture. In this day and age, I mean, it's definitely a YouTube phenomenon.
Yeah, so everyone's a critic, and now everyone's a parodist as well. You know, Weird Al was here on the show last year at the height of the Gangnam Style thing, and I asked him where's your Gangnam Style? And he basically said, you know, the landscape for making parody music has changed so much with the internet that it had sort of gone past it. The time passed almost as soon as it arrived. This is Weird Al talking about the change in pop parody on Soundcheck last year.
The digital distribution, I think, is going to be helpful. I haven't taken full advantage of that. Because part of what I do is to try to be as timely and topical as possible with the parodies. And just because of the simple fact that the old model was you wait till you have 12 songs and then you put out an album and then it's still months before it actually winds up in the stores. And nowadays, with iTunes and portals like that, there's the possibility for me to get things out more quickly.
That's Weird Al Yankovic. He mentions iTunes there, but let's talk about YouTube. Because that's where, I mean, it's like as soon as something happens, there are parodies of it on YouTube. Bauer, the Harlem Shake, for example.
Right, and that's an example of, I mean, that's a sort of a really weird, curious example of the parody there was sort of a visual joke, right? It was people dancing to this techno track, and when the beat really kicked in, they went nuts.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
In offices.
In offices, in unlikely places, in ridiculous costumes. You know, it was, I mean, it's just vaudeville. It's just slapstick almost. But that caught on, and this was at the precise moment that Billboard had, you know, remade its chart algorithm to take in YouTube views. So suddenly, this instrumental, vaguely trap music-like track became the number one song.
And when you say trap music, you're referring to the dance style.
Referring to the dance, you know, the hip-hop style.
Right.
It was a song which otherwise would never have cracked the top 100. Suddenly, it's number one song in the country for 5 weeks. And I think that speaks to the power of pop parody at this moment.
Just a little bit of Bauer's number one hit, Harlem Shake, and as Jody Rosen, pop music critic of New York Magazine, was just telling us, it became number one because the Billboard charts were revamped to include YouTube views, and with all the parody videos of that song, it did get catapulted to number one and stayed there for a number of weeks, which just underlines, Jody, the importance of video. We started by talking about the Lonely Island. You mentioned SNL, the Saturday Night Live videos that they did, which, however many views they would have had live on TV, is dwarfed by what they can do online now, right?
That's right. And in fact, yeah, the Lonely Island's their kind of first, I suppose you'd call it a hit, Lazy Sunday, the Chronicles of Narnia rap. That not only was the song that really made Lonely Island and made Andy Samberg a star, but it also, historians will point out, people who think a lot about YouTube will point out that really was a moment, a kind of watershed moment for YouTube as a medium, that suddenly everybody wanted to see this thing which had been on television in 2005. Viral videos hadn't quite happened yet. This was one of the very first viral videos. I think, you know, what we're seeing is music, the medium of the internet, and comedy coming together. The comedy piece, I think, really interests me because, you know, if you think about pop music really began as a mass medium, as musical comedy, at the turn of the century, in the end of the 19th century. You know, vaudeville, variety theater, was the place where pop songs were performed. And many of them came with punchlines. They were funny, jokey, novelty songs, many of them topical. So in a way, we're reverting. We're going all the way back to the 19th century now. You know, we're sort of circumnavigating back to the beginning because, a lot of our songs are songs with punchlines as well.
And a lot of them are coming out of late night TV. It doesn't have to just be Saturday Night Live. I mean, what about Jimmy Kimmel getting in on the act recently?
Right. Jimmy Kimmel, and of course, I think Jimmy Kimmel's trying to keep up with Jimmy Fallon, whose show is really in large part built around musical parody. He has this incredible crack band in the house, The Roots, who can, you know, dial up whatever he wants to do. I think one of the measures of this, you know, we talked a little bit about Lonely Island and their incredible guest list of stars. Well, everybody is getting in on this. You know, you'll see big stars. Mm-hmm. Bruce Springsteen will come on Jimmy Fallon's show and he'll make fun of himself in the 80s, dress up like he dressed on the Born in the USA tour and sing a jokey song. And even the President of the United States, Barack Obama, came on and slow jammed the news with Jimmy Fallon and The Roots.
Right. And just last week, Jimmy Kimmel released this song and video called "I Want a Channing All Over Your Tatum," which does in fact feature Channing Tatum along with Jamie Foxx and Olivia Munn, and this is what that sounds like.
I see a pretty lady sipping on a drink. I gaze into her eyes, then our glasses go clink, and I know I want a Channing all over her Tatum. Biatch, when you're
splashing in the water and you think you might drown. Channing tosses you his noodle and he calms your ass down. And just what, huh? He just Channing all over your tay down.
Oh, yeah.
Bow chime, see that foxy girl turning up that heat. Make her take them heels off, got them tattoos on her feet. And it's you, she want a Channing all over your tay.
I mean, what does that even mean?
Well, you know,
it doesn't have to mean.
It doesn't have to mean anything. There's actually a lot going on there when you think about it, because, I mean, on the one hand, I think we're really going too soon, if we haven't already, start to experience some parody fatigue. I mean, you know, when everybody and their uncle is doing it online, and now there's, you know, every dork who has a TV show is trying to do their version of Lonely Island. I think not only of Jimmy Kimmel, okay, who's got a little hipness factor, but Jay Leno recently parodied Taylor Swift's 22. That was sort of painful to watch. But if, in terms of Channing all over your Tatum, okay, it's a pretty debased version of it. But it is interesting because you hear Jamie Foxx there kind of setting up the exact kind of, like, you know, Casanova R&B that he performs. And I think what's good, or what's, you know, different about today's pop parodies, they're really, you know, they are savvy about genre. Mm-hmm. They're making fun. They're knowingly making fun of the sound of pop music and of its, you know, the leitmotifs of various genres. It's not just, for instance, like Tom Lehrer, who was a great lyricist, was a kind of minor genius in his way, but all he did was sat down at the piano and, you know, played a song.
Right, poisoning pigeons in the park or whatever.
Right. I mean, poisoning pigeons in the park is an all-timer. That is great. No offense to Tom Lehrer.
Yeah. Well, now let's talk about, you know, the staying power. I mean, you're parodying pop, something that by definition has its moment and then pop, it's gone. So parody, musical parody as something with a possibility of a shelf life would seem to be a kind of dicey situation.
Yeah, I think it probably is dicey in most cases. You know, I happen to, this is getting into my weird personal life, but I happen to collect turn-of-the-century joke books because they're incredible.
Turn of which century?
Turn of the 20th century.
Wow.
They're incredible visual artifacts, but they have great covers and stuff. The jokes are not funny. I can't understand the jokes. They're so unfunny. But, you know, jokes do have a relatively short shelf life. That said, there are some of these things which I think will stand. I think of Lonely Island's, can I say in a box on the air?
Why don't we say Richard in a box? Okay. No, let's say bleep in a box.
Bleep in a box. Yeah, when I think of Lonely Island's bleep in a box, that work?
Yeah.
In any case.
Thank you.
And now that is just sublime. I mean, that's just, it's so funny. It's such a spot on parody of kind of early 90s R&B. The video is great. Justin Timberlake's in it. I mean, that's something, that joke I think will still be funny 100 years from now. Not all of them will.
We've been talking about pop parody and the recent album by The Lonely Island called The Whack Album, which is out now. Jody's written about this for New York Magazine. You can find a link to his article on our website at soundcheck.org. And Jody, nice to see you again.
Nice to see you, John.
This is the song that can't mention the full title of, that Jody was just talking about, from the band The Lonely Island.
A gift for your special, so take off the towel.
Take a look inside, is my f- in a box?
It's in a box.
Not gonna get you a diamond ring. That sort of gift don't mean anything. Not gonna get you a fancy car. Girl, you gotta know you're my shining star. Gonna get you a house in the hills. A girl like you needs something real. Wanna get you something from the heart.
Something special, girl.
It's my in a box.
If you missed our recent live show in the green space, you can watch videos of our great guests on demand at soundcheck.org. Comedian Tig Notaro tells a very funny story about the aftermath of getting her wisdom teeth removed. Composer and TV producer Jeff Richman tells us about the musical adaptation of the movie Mean Girls that he's working on with his wife Tina Fey. And there's lots of live music from this guy, the pedal steel guitar virtuoso Robert Randolph. Hey!
Get ready.
Watch the video of Robert Randolph and the Family Band, plus my conversations with Tig Notaro and Jeff Richmond, all on soundcheck.org. Up next, we turn the tables on our series, That Was a Hit, about puzzling chart success. We'll hear about a very familiar song that wasn't a hit at all. This is Soundcheck.
And now, Soundcheck looks back at the pop charts of yesteryear and asks,
That was a hit?
Everybody was kung fu fighting.
They're coming to take me away, haha.
Time for another installment of That Was a Hit, our series about improbable chart success. But today, music critic and pop chart columnist Chris Melanfi has returned with a song that turns our series on its head, because surprisingly, this ultra-familiar song was never a hit. Chris, welcome back.
Thank you very much, John.
This song was not a hit for the band that originally recorded it, but
in its original recording,
if
that's
I say Fleetwood Mac,
right,
people will immediately think of maybe just a handful of songs, and Landslide would certainly be among them.
Definitely, especially if you've been listening to the radio any time in the last 20 years. If you flip on oldies or light radio right now, they're playing a Fleetwood Mac song, I'd give it a 1 in 3 shot they're playing Landslide. Landslide is kind of their big radio song of the last couple of decades.
But it's from their 1975 album.
Correct.
Called Fleetwood Mac.
The self-titled album that is, if I may use modern Hollywood sequel parlance, it's the reboot of the group, right?
Right.
The
moment this is when Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks joined the band.
Exactly. And basically changed them into a completely new, more California-oriented thing from the previous British blues-oriented group that had by that point released 7 or 8 albums.
Now, you know, that album, Fleetwood Mac, huge album, of course, would be eclipsed by the even bigger Rumours.
That's right.
Later on. But it had a whole bunch of singles. Landslide, I remember hearing Landslide as a kid.
I don't doubt you did.
But it wasn't a single.
Correct. There were a bunch of artists in the 70s who kind of had what I would call an embarrassment of riches. Elton John's a good example. There are many songs by him that are well known that weren't released as singles. Candle is in the Wind, the original version, was not released as a U.S. single. Billy Joel's another great example. Mm-hmm. New York State of Mind, improbably, never released as a single. Fleetwood Mac, by 1975, had the same wonderful problem. They had more songs than they needed to release as singles. There were 3 singles released from the self-titled 1975 album, Rhiannon, Say You Love Me, and Over My Head. All 3 were top 20 hits. And basically, probably because of the speed with which they then followed up with Rumours, or the slowness with which that first album, the 75 album, took to break, they were ready to move on to Rumours. They didn't need a 4th single. They never released Landslide. One imagines that had they gone to a 4th single, it would have been Landslide, but they didn't.
Well, that wasn't a hit.
I took my love, took it down. I climbed a mountain and I turned around. And I saw my reflection in snow-covered hills. Till the landslide brought me down. Oh, mirror in the sky, what is love? Can the child within my heart rise above? Can I sail through the changing ocean tides? Can I handle the seasons of my life?
Well, at this point, that is a very familiar sound from the band Fleetwood Mac, the song Landslide from their 1975 album Fleetwood Mac. But as Chris Melanfi has told us, that wasn't a hit.
Originally. That's right.
There were 3 other hits from that album.
Right.
You mentioned Say You Love Me, Over My Head. Was Rhiannon the first single off that record?
I believe it was, in the highest charting.
It
peaked just outside of the top 10. It peaked at number 11.
Yeah.
got to say, Chris, as a kid, I always wondered, well, Fleetwood Mac, why are they named after the drummer? You never hear him doing anything.
Right.
That's some pretty tasty drumming in that song.
Drumming and bass, frankly. That combination of John McVie and Mick Fleetwood is the core, the underpinning of their sound.
Rhiannon is the name of the song. That was a hit for Fleetwood Mac. Landslide, not released as a single, was not a hit for Fleetwood Mac for many, many years. Was it a slow burn, or was there something that happened along the way to turn things around?
I did a little bit of research about this. One thing I wanted to check is you can now go online and find set lists to decades worth of concerts. And Landslide was a concert staple. So if you saw Fleetwood Mac anytime between 1975 and about 1982, 83 through the Mirage Tour, you were probably going to hear Landslide in the middle of the set. So it wasn't, I'm not claiming this record was completely unknown and buried. Mm-hmm. Fans certainly knew it. I can't be sure, but I can't imagine that album rock radio wouldn't have played it occasionally. But it truly was kind of a buried classic. Interestingly, I did note that in 1987 on the Tango in the Night tour, it had been dropped from the set list entirely, which is sort of inconceivable if the song's a hit, right? Like, why would you ever drop it? Every other well-known Lindsey Buckingham, Stevie Nicks era Fleetwood Mac song is in the set. They're all there. Landslide is gone. So it really was kind of this underappreciated chestnut for a long stretch of their history. And think about all the Fleetwood Mac songs that got resurrected at various times. Don't Stop from Rumors became a pseudo hit again thanks to Bill Clinton in 1992. Right. So, you know, these songs were ripe for resurrection. The person who really deserves the full credit for unearthing Landslide, if you will, is of all people Billy Corgan of the Smashing Pumpkins. In 1994, he did a delicate acoustic cover of the song as a Smashing Pumpkins B-side, and that B-side was then later in the year released on a Odds and Sods collection by the Smashing Pumpkins called Pisces Iscariot. It was a hit collection because they were at the peak of their fame at that point. And on the Modern Rock chart, which is, you know, Billboard's alternative rock chart, it reached number 3. Amazingly, that was the first version of Landslide by anybody to chart on a Billboard chart in 1994. It reached number 3 on the Modern Rock chart.
To my love, to me down. Come on, not to around. And I saw my reflection in the snow-covered hill.
Billy Corgan of the Smashing Pumpkins doing his best Stevie Nicks impersonation there with the Smashing Pumpkins version of Fleetwood Mac's song Landslide. That did reach number 3, but that was on Billboard's Modern Rock chart, which
That's
is
right.
sort of an auxiliary chart, not one of the big ones.
Correct.
Did Fleetwood Mac at some point think, well, hey, they're doing well with our song. Why don't we finally release this thing as a single?
Pretty much. What then happened, and this was just, I think, good timing as much as anything, was this was the moment when Fleetwood Mac, that core lineup, decided to reunite. Various people had been in and out of the band, primarily first Buckingham, then Nicks. And then they put all of their differences aside for a 1997 concert special called The Dance, which was released and was a number one album. Apparently, there was a real hunger for Fleetwood Mac material. And arguably, the centerpiece of that concert was the band doing a lovely live version of Landslide. It's quite touching, actually, because there are moments in the song, and this is a drama that's recreated on stage with Fleetwood Mac all the time, where Stevie and Lindsey exchange this, you know, loving, pregnant look, if you will. And that was
because
a hit.
They were a couple.
They were a couple, yes. Lest we forget the drama of Fleetwood Mac in the 70s. Yeah. They came into the band as a couple, and all of the couples in the band dissolved during the making of Rumors. This
right.
is, you know, great rock lore. Anyway, that version, that live version from The Dance, was finally released as a single in 1997. It didn't even make the U.S. top 40, probably because it was such an old song. It did make it to number 51 in 1997. But at last, a version by Fleetwood Mac had at least charted.
Mm-hmm. And the story finally ends when Landslide does, in fact, hit the top 10 in 2002 in a version by
the Dixie Chicks. You have to imagine that after all of these various versions had hit, the Dixie Chicks, you can't blame them for deciding this thing was primed to be an actual hit. And on their third album with Natalie Maines fronting the band, they recorded their own take, slightly twangy. It hit the country chart, and it also hit the pop chart. And
number seven on the Hot 100.
All the way at number seven, that's right.
All right, so that wasn't a hit for the band that originally recorded it, but it certainly was finally, many, many years later, for the Dixie Chicks. Chris Melanfi, thanks for joining us once again.
Always my pleasure, John. Thank you.
Well,
so I'm on vacation the rest of this week, but I'm leaving you in good hands. A bit later on in the week, you'll hear singer, songwriter, and soundcheck.org sports blogger Erin McKeown. She'll be guest hosting the show. Tomorrow, though, it's Kurt Anderson from WNYC's Studio 360. He'll play some of the entries received in Studio 360's Battle of the High School Bands contest, along with one of the judges, musician Andrew W.K. And there'll be live music from singer, model, and former First Lady of France, Carla Bruni. That does it for tonight's show. Join us tomorrow at 9 o'clock for another Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer.